Okay, good afternoon, everybody. We will get started with our One Book event today. We're very excited to welcome Kelly Christian. So, Kelly, thanks for being with us today. For those of you that don't know, my name is Troy Swanson. I am the Library Department Chair. This is part of our One Book program on the novel Frankenstein, and we're doing a number of events, sometimes on themes. So, sometimes we talk about things that aren't related to the novel Frankenstein at all. But of course, some events like this one are right on target, right about the novel. And so this is very exciting. So I'm going to introduce Kelly and then I'll turn it over to her. So thanks to everyone for being here. Kelly Christian is a writer, artist, and activist. Her work explores the intersection between power, technology, death, and history in American culture. As part of her creative and research work, Kelly has photographed military funerals in Maine at the height of the Iraq War, published archival research related to postmortem photography, and given lectures in cultural heritage institutions, galleries, and classrooms in Chicago and beyond. She has written on such topics as the life insurance industry in the early 20th century, the troubling legacy of lynching photography, and the relationship between colonialism and taxidermy. Kelly continues to explore the more macabre moments in history and how they resurface in the contemporary social landscape. Kelly has written for CO Berlin, the National Museum of Civil War Medicine, the Clara Barton Missing Soldiers Office Museum, the Order of the Good Death, cultural criticism publications, and much more. Such impressive background. It's great. She currently works as a knowledge manager for Deloitte Global. Prior to this role, Kelly served as the archivist for Moraine Valley Community College, which is how we know her, and how she's such a good friend of ours and was a good colleague to have. And I just want to say thank you, Kelly, for donating your time to this and your expertise. So with that, I will turn it over to you. Thanks. Thanks, everyone.
Great. Thanks so much, Troy, for that lovely introduction. It's really nice to be back in the, good spirits of Moraine Valley Community College, a place near and dear to my heart. I really appreciate the opportunity. So we're going to dive in just a second. I'm going to go ahead and turn off my camera so folks can enjoy the slides on the screen. If you have any questions, feel free to hold them till the end and we can go through them together. So just a moment and we'll get started. So let's begin. In the summer of 1816, a group of friends got together in Switzerland to ride out an especially miserable European summer. Mary Shelley, her husband, Percy Bysshe Shelley, famed poet Lord Byron, and a few others were traveling from London and found themselves on the shores of Lake Geneva, where they engaged in robust dialogues and conversations about science and philosophy, seeking meaning and interpretation to the world around them. As a part of their sorry, excuse me. As a part of their time away and inspired from their deep conversations, each of these friends decided to pen a ghost story that would grapple with the lived complexities they had been discussing, human morality, the role of nature, and the messiness that existed between the built and natural environments. The only story to be completed ended up being Mary Shelley's Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus, a gruesome tale whose core theme grappled with moral responsibility, begging the question, what do we owe one another? The theme of anxiety permeates the narrative, intricately wound between the fabric of both plot and character. Published in a period of profound societal and technological upheaval, Shelley's masterpiece explores existential dread, large-scale societal fears, and the uncertainty of societal change. As readers traverse the haunting landscape of Victor Frankenstein's scientific ambitions and the tortured existence of his creation, the creature, they are confronted with a tapestry of anxieties that reflect not only Shelley's own apprehensions, but also the anxieties of her era. This talk will unpack and explore the many manifestations of anxiety within Frankenstein, examining how anxious sociocultural landscapes of the early 19th century Europe served as the ideal foundation for Shelley's unsettling tale, and how it seeks to illuminate anxiety, serving as both a driving force and a destructive power within the pages of Shelley's masterpiece. Beyond that, we will explore Shelley's own influences that would impact how she drafted her story. We will wrap up this talk by discussing how Frankenstein, as the story, still serves as a malleable and cautionary tale that has been imbued with topical meaning over the last 200 years since its publishing. And as noted, we'll have some time at the end for questions, so please hold on to those. Many pieces of great art are deeply influenced by the setting and environment in which they are created, with the influence and flavor of a certain era or moment present throughout the language and subtle references of a piece. The year of 1816 itself was dubbed the year without summer and had been acknowledged colloquially with other equally haunting names, such as the summer that never was, poverty year, and perhaps the most disturbing, 1816 and froze to death. This weather was triggered by the explosion of Mount Tambora, which had exploded on the other side of the world from Europe over a year before and wreaked havoc across the globe. On April 10, 1815, Mount Tambora, located on the island of Sumbawa, which we now know as Indonesia, erupted in the largest volcanic eruption in modern history by a long shot. The blast itself went 18 miles into the sky and released 24 cubic miles of ash, pumice, and gas into the atmosphere. The Mount Tambora eruption expelled 150 times more ash than the explosion of the recent Mount St. Helens, which erupted in 1980, creating consequences and impacts that affected nearly all parts of the world. In the immediate geographic region, the earthquakes that accompanied the eruption created savage tsunamis that shook the surrounding Java Sea, flooding people's homes and ruining farmland. The local devastation killed 10,000 people almost immediately. The ash fell fast and hard, and the debris tarnished the quality of fresh water for the inhabitants of the island. An additional 82,000 people would die worldwide from the far-reaching effects of Mount Tambora, driving the total deaths from this singular event to over 92,000 individuals. This initial impact came quickly, and many of the island's inhabitants did not realize that the rumbling was geologic in nature. In April of 1815, the British were the most recent colonizers of the region, having been in control for just under 4 years. Prior to that, the French had ruled briefly, who had themselves taken the island from the Dutch. In the days leading up to April 10th, there had been rumblings that caught the British off guard. They hypothesized that it was either cannons, pirates, or maybe a faraway volcano that was the cause of these loud, violent sounds. The British East India Company had actually sent a large ship to neighboring islands to find where the sound was coming from, but that exploratory British ship came back empty-handed. In a world where international communication traveled only as fast as the boat you sent your letter on, there were delays in reaching other countries and territories to tell them what had happened. By the time the word spread about the eruption of the volcano, the far-reaching effects of the blast had already begun to be felt. Historian William K. Klingemann and research scientist Nicholas Klingemann co-authored a seminal essay as well as a book on Mount Tambora, which described the effects of the explosion and explains why the impact was felt at such a global level. They write, "And so the extraordinarily fine sulfur particles from Tambora that reach the stratosphere remain suspended in the air for years, freely transported around the globe by the winds. By the winter of 1815 into 1816, the nearly invisible veil of ash covered the globe, reflecting sunlight, cooling temperatures, and wreaking havoc on weather patterns," end quote. Although photography was not available until 15 years later, landscape and urban paintings from these years depict a yellowish, grayish sky seen here that was showcasing how the light was muted. And those paintings, as seen here, document how different and how stressful this environment could really be. The weather made a huge impact on the climate, making giant global changes impacting people, food, weather, and every aspect of Earth that humans rely on to live. With this new understanding of the volcanic eruption, the suffering now had an explanation. However, the pain and harm caused that was so widespread was in no way able to recover quickly in the way that life once was. And this anxiety about the climate and the future was on the top of lists of the anxieties of their time. Just like our era, new technologies and changes in our day-to-day lives and culture often contribute to a great sense of unease about the future. The anxieties present in European culture during the 19th century are also prominent themes throughout Shelley's story. One significant influence was the intellectual culture of the early 19th century, which was marked by rapid advancements in science and technology, particularly in the fields of electricity, chemistry, and anatomy. It can be hard to imagine a moment in which development expanded the world so quickly, but consider the innovations that Shelley had watched develop in her young life. In 1800, the first wet cell battery was invented. In 1809, we were introduced to the arc lamp, also known as the first electric light. In 1814 was quite a year for innovation. The first successful steam locomotive had just made its debut, alongside the spectroscope, which was made for use in the chemical analysis of glowing objects. And lastly, 1814 brought us the major technological advancement and breakthrough. The first photograph was taken. It took over 8 hours to complete using a camera obscura, a kind of historic pinhole camera created with the entirety of a darkened room. And of course, it's important to remember that the invention of something new did not automatically mean that the product was available for use. But there may have been opportunities to learn and better understand these new developments and consider the impacts that they may have on the lived experience. As Shelley explored her world in London and noticed the buzz of change around her, that excitement can often be paired with a kind of existential dread or even uncertainty about the future. New technologies often invite difficult philosophical questions that explore how we see ourselves in the world. This is very notable right now with generative AI and even something such as electricity. When cities first became electrified and individual homes were added to the grid, some families were concerned about the safety of this new resource. It is easy to have fear about something we don't fully understand. And for those who had spent most of their lives without it, electricity represented an unknown future. What would the world be like if it was so different than the one you had experienced? It's likely that this sentiment could contribute to an ongoing sense of existential dread or isolation, two major themes noted throughout the book. Shelley was also immersed in discussions surrounding scientific breakthroughs through a circle of her acquaintances. This included her husband, as well as her close friend, the renowned poet Lord Byron. The novel reflects the anxieties as well as the ethical dilemmas that are provoked by these scientific advancements, especially the emerging idea of galvanism, the use of electricity to stimulate muscles, which fascinated Shelley and found its way into the creation of Frankenstein's monster. Shelley was also very much pulling on her own lived experience as she wrote her tale of horror and isolation, as she herself was grappling with her own uncertainties about the future. Prior to penning Frankenstein, Shelley had become romantically involved with a political associate of her father's who was already married. Very risque. Despite this, they spent the summer of 1814 traveling through Europe where Mary became pregnant. When they returned out of money and a bit destitute, Mary's father would not support them or see them, considering the out-of-wedlock pregnancy and the fact that he was still married. She became ostracized from her family, further adding to her own experience of isolation that would really flavor so much of the Frankenstein story. Mary would eventually give birth to a premature daughter, the first of four children to die very young in Mary's life. This first loss, however, was especially poignant. She would later recollect a journal entry on Sunday, March 19th, just 13 days after her young child had died next to her. Quote, "Dreamed that my little baby came back to life again, that it had only been cold, and that we rubbed it before the fire, and it lived, awake and find no baby. I find that the little thing all day, not in good spirits." End quote. This is not to say that Mary's experience with losing her infant child directly inspired the dark tale of reanimation, but rather to suggest that the despair of grief can have a great influence on creative production. It is difficult to separate the art from the artist. In the case of the book Frankenstein or the Modern Prometheus, we are influenced by the creative output of two authors. First, the author herself, Mary Shelley, crafts a stunning backdrop in which to flavor the unsettling narrative of the second creator at hand, Victor Frankenstein. As the reader, we are invited to also consider the doctor's own subjective lived experience as a character and also consider the way that he may imprint on the creature. We contend with both Shelley's vision and the vision of her character, both saddled with the weight of guilt and grief. Of course, as readers, we engage with that darkness that comes with Frankenstein. Shelley would go on to finish Frankenstein over the course of the following year, going on to publish for the first time in 1817. She would go on to publish just a small run of 500 copies and the books were sold and advertised in the newspaper. The book itself was sold as three segments bound into a single volume, which was advertised. And unfortunately, that first run came up with mixed reviews and slow sales. This is a great image of the original edition of Frankenstein from the Christie's auction when it was actually sold privately a few years ago. So it's kind of fun to see this in contrast too. And it's worth noting here that the first edition was actually published anonymously. However, it was dedicated to William Godwin, who was Mary's father. Many assume that the book itself was penned by Mary's husband, Percy Shelley, who was also a prominent writer. It's important to note, however, that the social expectations for women in the early 19th century London would have dictated that women focus on the family, let alone authorship of a horror novel. The dark themes, haunting imagery, and morbid horrors of bodily reanimation could not certainly have been written by a woman well enough to be trusted as a parent. The implications of that kind of dark mindset in a woman could, at the very least, harm her reputation and damage social relationships. At the very worst, she could be considered an unfit mother and her children could be removed from her care. The risk to publish in her own name was notable here and contributed to Shelley's own anxiety as she navigated whether or not to reveal her authorship. Reflecting on the creation of the story, the mindset of the author, and the social landscape of the era, the story of Frankenstein was destined to embody the complicated and uncomfortable themes being negotiated by its author. By understanding the climate and social landscape, we're better able to understand the details of anxiety that permeate the structure and the theme of the book. Once inside, the reader is also grappling with tension amongst the main characters and their relationships, diving into the psychological depths to reveal fear, guilt, and uncertainty that grounds the core themes of the story. At the core is Frankenstein's monster, an animated conglomerate of human parts trudged across a stormy and barren landscape, seeking refuge from his suffering, but unable to escape it. Created in isolation and rejected by its creator and society, the creature experiences profound existential anxiety and stress. It grapples with the questions of identity, belonging, and purpose, haunted by its own existence and the realization of its monstrous appearance. The creature's anxiety fuels its desire for revenge against Victor and its quest for acceptance and understanding, driving it to commit acts of violence and desperation. With an uncertain future ahead of him, the creature itself embodies the sense of uncertainty and unease that cannot be managed or controlled. From the onset of his scientific endeavors, Victor Frankenstein himself is plagued by anxiety. His obsession with pushing the boundaries of scientific knowledge and creating life leads him into a spiral of anxiety and guilt. He is tormented by the consequences of his actions, fearing the creature he has brought to life and the havoc it wreaks upon his loved ones. Victor's anxiety is deeply rooted in his fear of failure, his inability to control his creation, and the messy moral implications of his scientific pursuits. As Victor's fiancée and later wife, Elizabeth, also experiences anxiety throughout the novel, further contributing to the sense of discomfort that is shared between the main characters. She is deeply troubled by Victor's erratic behavior and his refusal to confide in her about the source of his distress. Elizabeth's anxiety is compounded by the threats posed by the creature and the uncertainty of her future with Victor, adding to her sense of vulnerability, fear, and loneliness. And lastly, there is Robert Walton, the polar explorer who delivered the story of Victor Frankenstein. Walton is driven by his own anxieties and ambitions. He embarks on a perilous journey to the North Pole in search of scientific discovery and personal glory, risking his life and the lives of his crew in pursuit of his goals. Walton's anxiety stems from his own isolation, his longing for companionship, and his fear of failure, mirroring the anxieties of both Victor and the creature, but adding an additional layer of complexity as the parallel themes of suffering and discomfort haunt these three connected men. In essence, Frankenstein emerged from a rich tapestry of influence, scientific, personal, and literary, that converge to create a timeless tale that continues to captivate readers and provoke thought on the ethical implications of scientific innovation and how the universal experience of great suffering continues to make Frankenstein a relevant and referenced story told and retold. The popularity of Frankenstein has continued as the need to interpret the classic tale with new analysis becomes available in our contemporary moment. In this way, Frankenstein has evolved to stay current and even into the 21st century, with each generation attaching their own unique read on it, reinterpreting as trends and norms change. In the current moment, the broader acknowledgement and engagement of mental health invites us to reconsider what additional, more nuanced reads are available. Anxiety is a relevant topic that is quite prevalent across the novel and is noticeable through the themes and characters as well as the author. In addition to that, we can consider how loneliness is also a core theme that may impact many characters, as well as grief and trauma. Again, these three topics have been relevant throughout human history, and I think are a testament to the mainstay of this book, but they are certainly having a moment right now, as grief, trauma, and loneliness have all been activated further in social media, popular culture, and even through different kinds of books and creation of art related to film. Isolation and alienation are two themes connected to mental health that drive components of the story and grapple with the philosophy of what we owe each other. Both Victor Frankenstein and his creation experience profound isolation and alienation. Both have detrimental effects on their well-being. In today's world, with increasing rates of isolation and loneliness, these themes in Frankenstein resonate strongly and also correspond to last year's One Book, One College selection at Moraine Valley, Seek You, A Journey Through American Loneliness by Kristen Radke. Making room to discuss the difficulty of feeling alone allows for us to push back against the stigma of keeping our suffering silent. By opening up, we give ourselves more options and flexibility along with our own sense of agency to approach our problems with support and the influence of those around us. The creature's experience of being rejected by society acknowledges the despair experienced by isolation and is a haunting reminder of how deep our suffering can get if we are unable to find support. In this way, the creature is understood to be a representation of Mary Shelley's own struggles with despair, isolation, anxiety, and depression. Acknowledging her great well of grief, the devastation of losing her first child, the abandonment of her father, Shelley was deeply impacted by these major traumas. Penning a story of her own creation, she provided an outlet to her feelings. Even as a fantastical novel, Shelley had the freedom to devise a true personification of her darkest moments, a monster too intense for this world, rejected and left to languish alone for eternity. And for those that struggle with depression or other mental health challenges, this depiction continues to resonate. In chapter 10, Victor Frankenstein describes his own isolation after he withdraws from society after his shameful experiment. He writes, "I am alone and miserable. Man will not associate with me, but one as deformed and horrible as myself would not deny herself to me," end quote. Ultimately, Frankenstein serves as a wary reminder of how bleak and heavy isolation can become when not given love and community. For Victor and the creature alike, both are alienated from any sense of support. They have no family or place or sense of belonging. For many pains, both physical and mental, healing requires the help and care of others. And the consistent acknowledgement of loneliness across the book is a quiet, although not subtle, reminder to the reader that we all bear some responsibility in caring for each other. In this way, Frankenstein continues to be relevant to contemporary topics in mental health by exploring universal themes of the human experience and prompting reflection on the complexities of the human mind and the psyche, but told through a fantastic new lens. These core themes come to life in the legacy of popular culture that Shelley's Frankenstein has given us, especially through film. There have been various classic depictions of Frankenstein that stay rather close to the book, such as the classic and often referenced 1931 film by the same name, starring Boris Karloff as the creature, which we have been seeing stills from the last few slides. There was also a 1994 remake, also called Frankenstein, where Robert De Niro stars as the creature, seen here on the left. But there have also been a plethora of more creative retellings, from the wacky comedy of the 1974 cult classic Young Frankenstein to 2015's Victor Frankenstein, starring Daniel Radcliffe as Igor. The classic literature is rife with potential for creative interpretation. In the last couple of years alone, there have actually been two major films re-engaging Frankenstein in brilliant, boundary-pushing ways. The recent release of Lisa Frankenstein just weeks ago was a fresh, campy horror film written by Diablo Cody. This feminist-forward approach to exploring Frankenstein just came out, so I have to admit to everyone, I have not seen it yet, but it's really exciting that it was just released and is re-engaging and reimagining this classic story with a very different approach. The other retelling of note included here is the recent hit Poor Things, a book written by Scottish author Alistair Gray, with the film adaptation directed by Yorgos Lanthimos. This came out at the end of 2023. The story is a riff on Shelley's Frankenstein and is set in Victorian London. In it, a young woman played by Emma Stone is found after she jumped off of a bridge. She is pregnant and she does not survive the suicide attempt. Her body is collected and brought back to the medical laboratory of Godwin Baxter, a Frankenstein-like surgeon who also experiments in reanimation. He discovers the fetus in the deceased woman's abdomen is still alive. He goes and removes the brain, transplants the fetal brain into the body of the woman, bringing her back to life, noting that she has the outlook and development of an infant, again, placed into the body of a grown woman. Hijinks ensue. Godwin names this new creature Bella, and Emma Stone comes to life, transforming the narrative of an isolated monster from Shelley's original telling into an avant-garde expression of feminism, a curious, worldly, and spirited exploration of morality and freedom across gender and ability. In Poor Things, the thread of empathy, love, and authenticity pulls the viewer through the film, paired with wacky, steampunk-influenced visuals that border on the surreal. The stunning retelling offers a thoughtful response to Shelley's horror masterpiece by reframing the power of the creature and offering it a further sense of agency while still grappling with the weight of morality and human suffering. Frankenstein, or the modern Prometheus, continues to be reanimated itself, coming back to the conversation despite being written over 200 years ago. The story serves as a mirror to reflect the struggles of the contemporary moment. Its universal appeal speaks to the need for readers to find solace from or validation of their suffering while exploring a reality that is outside of their own. While many notable influences for the book are related to early 19th century Europe, the story has continued to resonate and resurface across artistic mediums, providing endless opportunities to reimagine our own fears and anxieties brought back to life. Thanks.
Thank you. Thank you. That's so, there's so many things to say.
I covered a lot of ground.
Great. So yeah, fantastic. And brought it up to the present. So it's good. I will give everyone a chance for our folks who are with us to offer any questions, but I thought maybe I would open up with just a few things, Kelly, and get your thoughts. You know, you start out with the explosion of Mount Tambora, right? Do I get that right? Right.
Yeah.
And I only know roughly about this, and mostly I remember it because of your writing, actually. But 92,000 deaths is really striking. And so by introducing that, right, and talking about this background, I mean, are you trying? Is there like a direct connection, do you think, to the novel, or just more, this is what's bubbling underneath and this is the tone of the time, and like, how should we kind of grapple with that when we're trying to understand that connection?
Definitely. I'd be super happy to spell that out. I do think that there is like the larger kind of cultural impact that would influence Shelley, that kind of sense of unease. I sort of think about it how we consider climate change now, that kind of uncertainty that we have when we think about where I am today, it's really warm and like I have allergies in February. That's not quite right. But then, you can kind of, I think, apply some versions of that to how folks were grappling with what their world was doing to them in 1816. So let's say you have all of this ash, the sky is looking weird, but it's also that a lot of folks are dying. There's uncertainty about food, about travel, about your family. That certainly impacts it. But I will say too, part of the reason they went to Lake Geneva to kind of get away from the city is that like London wasn't great at that time. It was dirty, it was dark. Folks really wanted to get away from that. And when you have that level of suffering that's present, you think about the kind of energy in a city during COVID, like that way that Chicago felt during COVID was probably very different than someplace more rural. And that kind of pressure system that I think about experiencing, you have a lot of just, the need to get away maybe is a little bit stronger. And I think what allowed them to get away was this push to say, like, this doesn't feel great with us. Let's go to Geneva. Let's go to Lake Geneva and kind of, be with each other, have a moment to ourselves. They're middle class. They have access to some money to be able to travel. They set this aside to spend time with friends and then kind of deal with the existential weight of what the world is doing to them. I did some similar stuff myself during COVID of the need to just get away and figure out like what exactly is happening here. So I think there's a lot of parallels that we can look at in the contemporary moment and consider that, the anxieties that we feel were probably not too far off from them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think your connections, especially your point about mental health and the stigma of mental health and opening up, are really well made as you've built your argument. And I guess a thought that I had that when I, especially this year dealing with Frankenstein, and I love the 1931 film, but the 1931 film, of course, differs from the novel in a lot of ways. And the film is such a classic, and the film is like established. I think the monster is like this character in pop culture, really made like legendary status, kind of right, like iconic. But because it does differ from the novel, some of the failings of the 31 film kind of become our standard interpretation. And I think one real miss on that film is that it treats the monster almost childlike, right? Like you really are sympathetic in the film of the monster, and the monster's kind of where the monster attacks people. Like you feel for it because it's like this lost soul. But in the novel, that's not at all how it is. Like the in the novel, the monster is a fully formed person and has moral control, and can make choices. And to me, the real tragedy of the novel is, and I have a question here eventually, so I'm getting there. But there's kind of like a double tragedy, right? Like Frankenstein rejects the monster, but then the monster could also have compassion, but doesn't. Like then the monster chooses revenge, right? And so they get locked in this kind of death spiral. And so in so many ways, it's a double tragedy where I think other tellings of the story are not, and so I guess maybe I don't have a question, but I think your point about the opening up and talking about those stigmas that we carry with, I think you have two people here in the novel who choose not to open up, right, and embrace their darker emotions. So I guess my question is like, is that, do you agree with that? Do you have thoughts on that reading? And like how, like what does that say in terms of that care about addressing that stigma, I guess.
Very much so. I think it is like, the way that I sort of mentioned earlier, like that is the warning, right? Is like if we never grapple with the depth of our own trauma, whether it's something that was done to us or something that we made, the free choice to do, we're still accountable to some level of not acting like our entire life's purpose is to get revenge. That is certainly not a helpful way to move through the world, but also like is a giant detriment to like the systems that we have to care for each other. So I think it also it discourages a sense of community building when we deeply isolate like that too. And even if we are dealing with the difficulty and the weight of something like depression or anxiety or mental health struggles, I think it's an important thing to note, like we have to be able to tolerate some discomfort in life in order to grow, right? Like one of my friends mentioned recently that the best way to deal with being scared is to know that you're going to have to be brave next. Like it's the opportunity to be brave. And I think that that really has resonated because it isn't an easy thing, I think, to just, you know, try to do repair, right? This book is sort of a warning of what happens when we don't engage in repair, which I think we could probably extrapolate quite a bit for like the social and cultural moment that we live in. But I think that there isn't the lack of ability to acknowledge repair in the book, do well for it. You're still going to be with the weight of that pain with you forever if you just never acknowledge or deal with it.
Yeah. And of course, it's, you know, mental health is always very complicated. And so, but yes, you know, the thing that's so rich about this novel is there's always so many things that you don't like, so many ways to read and think about it. And I think you've really given us a very convincing and layered argument. And again, the argument about how it's still relevant and then pulling in the new interpretations. It's such a for a 200-year-old novel, it's still alive and teaching us. So and then how does this, like, I'm always interested, of course, in your larger work around death and the macabre and all these pieces, right? Which is something that maybe is unique in its own way, right? Like this exploration. I don't know where I'm going with this, but like as you're exploring this, how often do you stumble upon Frankenstein? I'm sure Frankenstein pops up, but also, you know, does Frankenstein help frame some of your larger explanations about like how we see this, you know, part of living is recognizing death, right? And living with death and being part of that. Does Frankenstein offer commentaries in some of your other works and your, you know, like, you know, what's the Kelly Christian thesis, you know, as you've explored this as an artist and thinker?
Definitely. I think it really does resonate. I think that my core kind of impulse grappling with these uncomfortable topics is that like death is always going to be there. And the less that we engage with it, the harder it's going to be. And so I think Frankenstein gives us, again, aside from the warning aspect of it, it's really about grappling with uncertainty and uncomfortable stuff in general. I am motivated to talk about a lot of this because I feel like I don't have a choice. Like these are things that show up forever for all of us, and they do have a huge emotional impact. I think I'm the kind of person who feels very compelled to be able to talk about things all the time of all kinds of things. It's a really important part of me being a kind of open person who invites in these kind of more difficult conversations, especially when it comes to death. So for me, like Frankenstein is always relevant because it's always like, ooh, if you don't want to talk about something uncomfortable, like here are our models. Here's what art is showing us as a possible response to that is the limitation of like human connection is real. If we are unable to like fully have the space to both process our difficult feelings around death and grief, I think that we would have a real hard time supporting somebody when they inevitably lost someone, supporting ourselves when we inevitably lose someone. And also on a more holistic scale, like I think that we don't get to advance our emotional maturity and intelligence if we aren't able to grapple with the true reality is that we all die. And so Frankenstein gives us a sort of avenue of sort of exploring what it looks like. I think that everyone, you know, and myself included, we all struggle to find our own unique way to talk about death and loss. But I think something like Frankenstein allows us to sort of make it like more imaginative, more exciting. It gives us a possibility of trying on a new perspective in a way that other, I think, fiction doesn't necessarily grapple with because of the themes that are always present in this book.
Yeah, fantastic. All right. Well, I'm not seeing other questions, so I think we are at a good spot. So again, I just want to say thank you, and it's great to see you, and thank you for everyone who attended. So
awesome.
Thanks. I feel
thanks
like
so
you know, when we're in person in the library and we have a big audience, where you know there's always like the round of applause. So I'm going to send out the virtual round of applause. So
Awesome.
Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the opportunity. Don't be a stranger, and really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks.